Welcome to the Memory Core, episode 444. Adam, you are not going to believe this.
What's
up? Guess what?
What's up?
Quixel personally called me and we have a sponsorship. You know they're doing a buy one, get one tank deal right now?
Oh, man. Does that mean we actually have enough money to put up a podcast?
Yeah, I sure hope so. Quixel, if you don't want to break the bank, just buy a tank. We'll give you two. I thought I'd surprise you with that one.
I hope this ages well.
Probably not.
Hey guys. I've been taking some advice from you guys. We were looking for podcasting platforms, and then life and overwhelming laziness got in the way. So we do not yet have a podcast set up, but we'll get there
eventually.
Maybe.
Definitely laziness though.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, laziness. We will do it. We will do it. I promise. We will do it. I just can't promise you when. It'll be ready when it's ready.
Yeah, when we figure it out and life doesn't start kicking us in the nuts all the time.
Yeah. Since we last talked, which has actually been a little bit longer than I thought. I think we were going to do this like, what, 2 or 3 weeks ago, and then it ended up being like, yeah, a little bit longer. But hey, it's January, so we're still good. We kind of wanted to update you guys on some of the art. We were talking about art last time and sort of the things that concerned us. And, since then, we had the Ost Soul revealed and we had a couple other stuff that came out. And I think a lot of our main points still kind of stood.
Yeah, I sure feel like that.
Yeah, I think one of the big things was just... Dan had mentioned, and I think he used a really good term, was the genericness of some of the designs. And not...
Well, the genericness, but all of it kind of blends together. We're kind of losing the...
Individuality.
Yeah, individuality, and we're losing... Because what people don't understand is there's multiple manufacturers in this universe. Mm-hmm. At least new people getting into the game. So you're kind of missing out on... I don't know, like, if you see a difference between, like, what are two popular, like, GM and, Ostman Industries.
Yeah, I think, the big thing was with the Ost Soul is that the original Ost Soul had a very humanoid face to the cockpit, whereas the Ost Rock had sort of a circular cyclopean eye. And then in this new Ost Soul that Scroggins... put out as a proposal, had the Ost Soul weapons and layout, and the actual body shape was actually pretty good. And I have no problem with the body shape. It's a little bit beefier than the original Ost was, but that's okay because the original Osts were actually based off of the Walker pods from Robotech, and so it had a very alien appearance. And what Fawcett is, they just put arms on it and then put a head. So. With this Ost Soul, it had a really nice proportions, really nice body shape, but the head, the cockpit shape, rather than being a sort of anthropoid face, had the Ost Rock cyclopean eye. And the question is, well, then what the hell does the Ost Rock look like? If it already has this major calling to, what's going to happen? What's the Ost Rock going to be looking like? And one of my other concerns was the same sort of cockpit glass panels, the way the glass was framed looked very similar to what was already on the Orion and the Longbow and to a lesser extent the Behemoth. And I had mentioned that to Scroggins, and I think he sort of agreed with me a little bit. To be fair, he is making 100 of these things. Like, it's hard not to let your tendencies in what you do creep into them. But I was like, because I was telling you, Dan, that in the old art, for a long, long time, for better or for worse, I'll cop to it. The 3058 Nightstar is kind of goofy looking. The miniature is kind of goofy looking. It kind of looks like a bent over Mickey Mouse with its big freaking gloved hands. But you could do a tight close-up on any battle mech on the face. And you would be able to know which one that is, whether it was an Archer or a Marauder, an Orion, a Battlemaster, a Charger, an Atlas, a Banshee, a Firestarter, and everything. They were all different.
Not so much now.
Not so much now. That's a concern. Like, are we losing some individuality because we're afraid of it, you know, quote unquote, looking goofy? Looking.
I like the Ost until you pointed that out to me too.
Yeah. And it's just sort of like, oh, damn. Was so happy with it until, you know, and I think that's one of the things, like even like the Valkyrie and the Phoenix Hawk in the original Unseen Art, granted because they were all based off of the Veritech fighters from Robotech, they looked very similar. But even then, like you could look at the Phoenix Hawk, the Wasp, and the Valkyrie, depending on how the Phoenix Hawk's head was drawn, depending on, you know, what book you were looking at, because that did vary quite a bit. But you could look at particularly the Valkyrie and the Wasp, and even though they're very similar, they still look different enough. Like the Valkyrie had sharp edges to it that made it look like almost like it had the proboscis of a wasp, or like an actual wasp or a bug or an insect. And like the Wasp battle mech had more of a round ovoid shape, whereas the Stinger had more of the, you know, the boxy TV, you know, cockpit. And that's a concern. Like, are we losing this individuality? And I think you could really see it in the Fire Moth, like this sort of resistance to wanting to see these upwards reverse canted arms, and all he does is just bring him down close and tight to the body, to like the point where they're actually non-functional.
Now they can't, you know, swerve side to side. They can't. It's just. Even the skirt in the back is gone. They
Right,
put
right.
it like we'll replace the skirt with two tubes that run down the back. Like that's any better.
Yeah. And so it's like this is like this resistance, and it's almost like I guess the way I see it is that I'm not a big fan of pop music, but no longer being a moody, pissy teenager, I can hear pop music and I can kind of look at it maybe a bit academically because I do play a musical instrument and I can recognize where things are difficult to do or there's like really cool harmonization. If you guys haven't followed him or seen any of his videos on YouTube, there's a bass player named Adam Neely who's done a lot of like really cool things. He's got like a lot of really cool educational videos and he's done a number of reharmonizations of pop songs. Like he's got one like Adele's Hello that is like fucking smoking, man. Like it just layers chord changes on chord changes and chord changes. And so what he's done is instead of like tossing what's been done because it's quote unquote goofy, he's sort of embraced it and leaned into it and found ways to,
Make it work.
yeah, or even to accentuate what's weird, to lean into it. And I think it's almost like a lesson that can be taken. You know, lean into it and see what you can get that's weird.
Enhance, don't improve.
Yeah, like look at, yeah, because, you know, is it gonna look, like I said, is it gonna be in, you know, in 10 years, or is it gonna be like, oh, you know, we should have done this or we should have,
Well,
you
I mean,
know, put the.
there's beauty in simplicity.
Yeah. But you know, it's one of those things, like, yeah, the genericness. Yeah. Like you were saying, Dan.
Yeah,
'Cause I know
everything
you're a
just.
Firemoth fan.
Yeah, I know. You ruined that for me too.
Yeah, sorry. I'm good at what I'm good at. And it's again, you know, Scroggins is a better illustrator than I'll ever be. He has a very good innate talent. I just, you know, or some of the decisions, you know, they're gonna come back to haunt us. Because I think even he released a new updated Orion recently that I think.
They had a poll for which cockpit that, or not necessarily a poll, but he was looking for input to see which cockpit the community liked better.
Yeah, well, and they all like the newer one. And then, of course, you know, more of the old school guys like the older one, because the older one, you know, helped define the Orion, and it kind of matched actually closer to the new sculpt Orion that came out a couple of years ago. That's actually been well received by the community, and I think, you know, the higher ups at Catalyst said, no, you really gotta kind of evoke more of the older style art. And I don't know if I make no pretensions to be like, oh yeah, like the guys at Catalyst read my comment and they're like, oh, he's totally right.
Yeah.
We need to name our firstborn children after him. It's like they're not doing that, but I think
Please
it's
don't.
yeah.
He already has enough of an ego.
Yeah. But I think they're probably kind of all thinking the same thing, right? I mean, they're all thinking the same thing. So I do have an ego.
I didn't mean in a bad way.
But yeah, it was just sort of one of those things like you know, because the things that our Scroggins are doing, they're kind of showing up more and more. That sort of like touches by him. It's like, you know, it's something that he's done because he has his own style. And I was thinking about this. Like, there are some. There's a sax player who's I don't think I call it famous, but I mean, he's quite successful. He does have a pretty big following, and he's been in a couple of couple of bands out of New York, one called Too Many Zoos and one called Lucky Chops. And he plays more of a sort of a dance groove style on a saxophone, and he plays a Barry Sax. And he's awesome. Like, he does a lot of like really cool, really difficult things on the sax that are just like glissandos. Glissandos on a keyed instrument, not. Like, it's almost like a slide, like a trombone slide. And to do that with a keyed instrument is not easy stuff. But he can do it. And he's a phenomenal player. But when he gets to his solos, he has these things that he does. It's kind of like, yeah, this is me. And it gets kind of repetitive. And it's one of those things like, he's great, but he's repetitive in a way that's like John Coltrane and other classical saxophone players, not classical, but like classic jazz players, did not do. And so it's kind of one of those things. I see that with Scroggins, and it's funny, you know, I just read a history of the saxophone, being a saxophone player myself, and it's really cool because you see the sort of differences between jazz players and classical players. You know, jazz players seem to be very warm and friendly, like the successful ones. Like, there was anecdotes about Charlie Parker, like, you know, making sure all his bandmates are eating and like helping out young players. And like, there's a really sweet anecdote of him sort of coaching Phil Woods, who had also become this really famous alto saxophone player. He passed away about, you know, 4.5 years ago. And you contrast that with classical saxophone players, and they're not all like this, but some of the big ones like Marcel Mule and Sigurd Rascher, the sort of founders of the French and German school of classical playing. And again, like, both phenomenal players, but they did not get along. It the way they were talked about, it's almost as like they never experienced any joy in life. They were absolutely miserable fucking people to spend any time with, like totally insufferable, you know, not warm or gracious or like eager to teach. Like, they were eager to teach because they did it, but like, they did, it's like they seemed like they were very overbearing and just torturous to their students.
Sounds like a really good time.
And it's just one of those things, like, they just, if you ever read an interview with Alan Moore, the comic book writer Alan Moore, like, it just sounds like just spending any time with this person, and he's like, just take me to the dentist and just like pull my teeth. And it's just insufferable to be around. Speaking of insufferable,
No. Get the unsubscribe buttons ready, guys, because we're going for a ride.
today's gonna be probably part one of who knows how many about our opinions on the clans.
Dun dun dun.
So yeah, well, how about this? I know, Dan, you're more of a clan fan than I am.
Yeah, a little bit more. And it's mostly because of my introduction into the game. I was one of those.
Well, I mean, my introduction to the game was the cartoon, and so the clans were like this really phenomenal antagonist. But it was you, MechWarrior 2, right?
Oh yeah, MechWarrior 2. So the way I looked at the
The PC
universe is a
game, yeah.
lot different.
Yeah, the PC game,
The
right?
P yeah, PC game, not MechWarrior Second Edition.
But I mean, because one of the things we want to talk about was sort of our perspective of the game, kind of like the start of the clans, and not so much like chronologically in universe, but sort of chronologically in development. And then maybe we'll do it this podcast, maybe the next one, sort of our problems with how the clan introduction changed the board game, and then sort of the things that, I mean, at least irritate me about their culture, and how it kind of works in sort of the meta of the universe. So yeah, I mean, I don't know if I mean, what your first introduction to the clans was MechWarrior 2, but what was your first introduction to the clans, or how you sort of absorbed them in the context of the game itself?
So in the game, I started obviously a fourth edition. I mentioned that a lot. And when we started, or we got a gaming group together, we were playing a lot of, MechWarrior 2. And then I think around the time we got into it was also MechWarrior 4, which is where everything kind of mixes together. Because you had, like, Clan Tech wasn't necessarily in its own bracket. It was like kind of the improvement. of the InnerSphere technology that you started with.
Yeah.
So that's how we chose to play a lot of our games. So a lot of the first playing experiences I have with BattleTech the board game were using clan technology and custom Omnimechs and things like that. I mean, just to give you an idea, my friend Drew at the time, his big thing was a Warhawk, and he basically made it 100 tons and had enough heat sinks to fire every single PPC at once. Even dabbled in, God, what was the name of the designers back then? There was Battlemech Designer, there was, well, whatever the other one was, I think it was like Mech Engineer, they had rotary autocannons in it. And he had a rotary autocannon 10 on one of his variants.
Because right, because we were sort of getting, we probably kind of got the internet at the same time.
Yeah, dial-up.
Right after sort of the Foster was releasing the field manuals, you got all this like sick new technology, like the rotary autocannons and the Gauss rifles, and you know, MaxTech had come out, and yeah, so we're probably,
yeah, because MechForce UK actually had clan rotary autocannons. Not a lot of people remember that, but they did, and that's what he used. And our games were basically formed around like Clan Jade Falcon, because that was his favorite clan. And we did a like Falcon versus Wolf, Binary versus Trinary, which we gave the Trinary stock clan mechs, and the Binary we had our different commanders with their own like home variants. Mine wasn't as bad. I had a Shadowcat. I didn't play with like the armor or anything. But mine was kind of close to like a Phoenix Hawk. So okay. I had like an ER large laser, I think 3 medium pulse lasers, and a Streak SRM-6.
That's pretty solid. That's pretty nasty.
Yeah, because yeah. I tried to do things that were kind of, like it was kind of munchy, but it was a little more geared towards how variants looked in the universe.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
even my brother, when he played with us, he had a Cauldron Born, and he was playing with heavy lasers. So he had like two heavy large lasers, like I think like an LRM 15 or 20, like a Streak SRM 6. It's like even his were kind of geared that way.
Yeah.
But, or like my friend Alan had a Turkina that had, it lobbed probably over 100 LRMs. Like he just, he had an obsession with LRMs.
And well, clan LRMs, right? Like the best freaking weapon.
Yeah, I know. I just, I
saw
that.
We'll get to it. We'll get to it. We'll get to that.
I saw the look on your face change, like, oh, that mother.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that's basically what our games were. And that I started getting a little more munchy too. Like I took a Penetrator and I put like clan pulse lasers and stuff on it and beefed it like 80 tons. And we were playing with like, at the time, like compact gyros and like hardened armor and things like that.
Yeah.
So when I started getting sick of that, and Alan, who you know, my friend Alan, who's played with us in our recent campaigns, he got sick of it too.
Yeah.
And we were like, hey, you know what we should do? We should try doing a like 30, 25 era. We could do like our own, this is like a suggestion for me. We could, you know, kind of play like, like how the fluff works in the game. Like we could be scavengers and go from, you know, star system to star system, like a full blown campaign, and that was it. Group over.
Oh man, that sucks. You know, I you know, for me it was the cartoon, and then my friend found, and I think I told you this before, and I think I've told you, the audience, this before.
But, oh yeah, we're probably gonna be repetitive with this.
So I mean, just as a refresher, you know, my friend had found the City Tech 2nd Edition box set at the local hobby store, and then I found 3rd Edition BattleTech at the local hobby store. And, you know, for him, like, the power of those weapons, because my friend at the time, I mean, and he still kind of is, and I haven't really seen him for a long time, although I did run into him in the grocery store last week out of nowhere, which was actually nice to see him briefly, but really, like munchy to the max. And then when he wasn't being munchy, he was like playing with sort of newish gear just because, like, this was years ago. I was back from vet school for a little bit, and we got together to play a game. And rather than like actually like coming up with a force with which to play the game and to actually play a fair fight and competitively, you know, I had taken my Lance of Max that we had thought we were taking with a set battle value. And he took like two custom designs with a bunch of rocket launchers because of like reasons. And I totally fucking blew out of the water because, of course, of course, like, he fired all his rocket launchers at once and missed because we used group firing rules and shut down. And I was like,
I will say,
why? I know, like, and rocket launchers can actually be pretty powerful.
They are my guilty pleasure.
But it's just sort of like, okay, like, here we're going to play, like, an actual match, and you took a bunch of one-shot weapons.
It's definitely a fluff weapon.
And you fucking missed? And now it's done? I haven't played a game in, like, 2 years. This is it?
Yeah.
So, yeah, that sums up. Like, my friend is the guy who would take the Dire Wolf. Prime. Corner my rifle, man. Group firing rules again. Alpha strike. Miss with everything. Oh. Shut down. Thankfully, not blow his ammo up. But shut down. At which point, I would just, like, kick the mech and it'd fall over. And then just... This would be my experience with playing with my friend. And it's like, okay, this is not rewarding.
I almost feel like we're having some kind of like I'm your psychiatrist right now.
Yeah, yeah.
You're laying on the couch talking about this.
Right.
I wonder why you're so bitter.
Well, you know, it's like you part of playing the BattleTech is the universe. That's, I think it's what drew everyone in. And we'll get to it too. It's in the beginning of Shrapnel, which was an anthology series. I think it was produced in 88 or 89. And Jordan Weisman has an introductory essay about the universe. One of the things that drew people in was sort of the universe setting itself, the scavenger setting, and the sort of the royalty, the sort of neo-feudalism, and what it means to own a battle mech, and exploring those vistas that BattleTech presented. And I couldn't explore those vistas with my friend because he wanted to just be like a clan player who maxed out his Omni-Mech and would just either, like, steamroll you because it was clan tech, or alpha strike and shut down.
It gets old after a while, doesn't it?
It does. It does. there wasn't much of that sort of that careful, considerate gameplay that you're riding the bell curve of the dice, right? You're riding that curve and taking those risks, but, you know, strategy still does play a role. And the dice provide enough of a randomness that your well-laid strategy can fall apart. Or you could be at the receiving end of that strategy. You could be biting your nails because, you know, like, it just takes that one hit to your torso to cause that ammunition explosion because the armor is stripped off. And, like, somehow you survive. And it's such a thrill ride. But you don't experience that with the wrong players. You know, you really don't see that.
No, you don't. You don't have to breach your own mech when you fall in at depth one water hex.
Yeah, do you want to tell that story or should I tell that story?
you can tell it.
So we were playing
the commando.
Yeah, we were playing a scenario is out of the Kel Hounds book. And I mean, it was really written to really be a fair fight, but for a while there, like, Dan was playing the Direct Chronos Combine and I was playing the Kel Hounds, and it's a total numbers mismatch, but the Kel Hounds players have such a higher skill role. And Dan had the commando, right?
Mm-hmm.
And just like Dan's dice were just hot, like cockpit hits and pilot knockouts and just giving me a really hard time. And then about halfway through, I think things turned. I think in the end, you still won the scenario, but I think the most brilliant moment was I had knocked down his, was it a Stinger you were in or was it a commando?
Actually, I did it to myself.
Yeah, yeah.
I jumped. I took a risk and jumped. I forgot why. There was an actual reason to it.
Yeah, I don't know if it was like a gyro hit, like, or if it was...
No, he didn't have a gyro hit or anything. It was something. Like, it was starting to get risky to keep him where he was. I forget how, because it was like, what, a year
something,
ago?
Something forced you to do a piloting skill roll.
Yeah, it was the jump into the water hex.
Yeah.
And...
You fell, right?
I fell and failed that, and I had to do a breaching roll. And
which you did not know about.
I did not know. So, and in all fairness, in the introductory box set, which is where I played most of my games, there are no breaching rolls.
Oh, okay. Okay.
There are none listed in
but
there.
But it's in Total Warfare. And essentially, if you take... Because you fell, right? You fell.
Yes.
And I can't remember what section you landed on.
And it was one of my torsos.
Yeah. But it didn't penetrate. It didn't blow past the armor, the falling damage, but...
That water sure did.
Yeah, anytime you take a hit underwater to locations underwater, even if it doesn't penetrate the armor, you have to do a roll for a potential breaching hit. as in that whole section then becomes flooded with water. And Dan had no idea. He's like, you're full of shit. What are you talking about?
Well, I knew about breaching, and the way I was used to it was if you had no more armor on that location, you land in water, it's gone.
Yeah, yeah. So Dan was like, I gotta look this up. So we looked it up. And it's like a high roll too. So it's like the rules are like what, like a 10 or above?
Yeah.
It breaches.
My hot dice betrayed me.
And then the whole section flooded. Oh, it was brilliant. I think I was laughing for like 5 minutes after that. It was pretty good.
I was like, man, the one time I wanted to be a rules lawyer. It worked out for me.
Yeah. But
you know, the cool thing is like when we game with each other, like it's not rules lawyering in a sense where we're trying to like outdo each other. It's more like, really? Because I don't freaking remember that.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. It's just fun stuff like that that you don't really experience in other games that BattleTech has. But we wanted to kind of back up here for a second. I think one of the big things, and what I would love to see, maybe it's a bit self-indulgent to think of this, but yeah, I mean, you know, there are people out there, you know, who are sort of, you know, academics who look back and they'll write books on the history of something. They'll write a book on the history of, you know, Jack Kirby, or on the history of, you know, a musician or something like that. And I think, you know, BattleTech has had enough words printed for the game, and I think has had enough of an impact on people that I think it really would be interesting to see sort of an inside or academic look on the development of the game.
Well, when everybody talks about the history of BattleTech, they always like to look inside of the game.
Right.
They don't necessarily look at the outside.
Right.
And
right.
What kind of got us into this was following the Charette collection, because that's what reminded us about the shrapnel.
Yeah, yeah,
the
yeah.
The whole entry in it.
Yeah.
He actually posted about it. And yeah, so
what's the guy's name? Do you have the copy of the book or shrapnel or no?
No, I actually do not have shrapnel.
So, but yeah, I have it. I should have brought it up. But there's a guy. So Jordan Wiseman, he came up with the idea of it because he was back in '84. I think he was at some convention and saw a bunch of the models for Macross, not Robotech Macross. Slight difference. That's just me splitting hairs. But Macross and Doug Ram, and I mean Doug Ram was pretty cool because it had this very sort of down-to-earth, gritty, you know, military feel. And Robotech had more of the super robots. But even Doug Ram had more of a super robot thing. Like, the Doug Ram, which what we would know as a Shadowhawk, still had, you know, abilities and capabilities, you know, well beyond the other forces' mechs. And so the Doug Ram could just, you know, wreck everybody. And that's a very Japanese concept. And so a lot of times the plots of Japanese anime seems to be more character driven rather than plot driven. Like, you have to achieve this thing, you know, because of X reason, and then your characters, this character's sort of pros and cons kind of help or get in the way of that, and how its interactions with the plot are interesting. Whereas in more of the Japanese thing, it's like the underarching plot is more of a side story and a vehicle to see these more character-driven stories. And, you know, I think here's another thing that's going to probably cause people to unsubscribe. I am not a big fan of Neon Genesis Evangelion. I know it's a really renowned and beloved anime.
It's okay. I tried and I could not
get into it. I can't give it another pass. I can't give it another watch because it's so frustrating. It's like the whole time it's just like, Shinji, you depressed motherfucker, just get in the fucking robot and save the goddamn world.
Stop being Kai.
Take some fucking Zoloft and get the job done. Which is maybe not a healthy attitude. It's very much like in the veterinary world. It's sort of thing like, oh man, I fucking hate this dog, but I gotta do this. And like, it's trying to bite me and just have to do it. Just gotta push through no matter how tired I am, because this dog needs me.
I really don't want to drill this Mosler safe. There's Ralsom in it.
Yeah. Yeah.
They have a contract. Yeah. Oh man, I got to do this.
So that's kind of what Jordan Wiseman was saying. Was he, to him, from his Western perspective, he didn't really like a lot of the plots and stories of Japanese anime. And I definitely agree with that. I mean, there are some animes I really do enjoy and I really do like, but you know, in general, like, yeah, like I you know, from my Western eye, I kind of want to see a different type of story.
He was looking for a more like text-storied approach.
Yeah. Well, the other thing too is, you know, obviously all these battle mechs are kind of relatively equal in capability. You know, a point of armor in a Locust is the same as a point of armor on an Atlas. I mean, the Atlas has more armor, but it's not like, you know, a Locust is going to run through and just like destroy everything with its medium laser like it would in like an anime.
Yeah.
You know,
one shot a marauder.
Yeah. They just are like Goku and Dragon Ball, you know, he just digs a little deeper.
Yeah.
And he does it, you know. It's
I'm going to stand with my arms up. That spirit bomb's going to last 5 episodes and I could take a beating, but
it's
going to happen.
It's just sort of that thing like, oh, if you just dig a little deeper, you try a little harder.
Inuyasha.
We're all
Kagome. Here. Inuyasha. Kagome.
I'm more of a Yamcha.
Yeah. We were there, you know, for like Adult Swim, like at the start, and a lot of the animes that were presented on there, like, you know, we've seen at least a couple episodes of them, and it's just like, I know they're not all like that. I know there's definitely a lot of
BattleTech was more of the Cowboy Bebop of all of them, like standing out, you know, because it actually has a theme.
Well, you know, the thing too, you know, kind of bummed me about Cowboy Bebop. It started out like had all these like kick-ass jazz songs and like these sort of really cool action scenes, and then it kind of gave way to something else, which is not maybe not fair. I should probably give it another listen to again, but it seemed like the punch and energy of the first couple episodes of Cowboy Bebop seemed to very quickly leave the series.
It was the theme of the whole show that kept me gripped.
Yeah,
because they did hold on to the theme for the whole series.
Yeah. I probably should give it another listen to or another watch. But anyway, kind of circling back again, in that opening of Shrapnel, what was the guy's name? Damn.
I can't. So yeah, if I had the
book. Was it Perkins? He was the one that kind of came up with a lot of the backstory based off of, I'm going to look up that Shrek collection and see what that says. So we're going to keep talking. But Wiseman kind of came up with the main setting, and then this other guy kind of came up with the backstory, and to kind of come up with the clans, I was looking at sort of the series of mentions of in the early fiction and see kind of when the idea of the clans was starting to crystallize and how it was being formed.
Yeah, we were after seeing that post.
You go, Pat Larkin.
Pat Larkin.
Pat Larkin's his name.
Yeah, because we're kind of like, I wonder where it started to become obvious when the clans were going to start approaching. Like, when did you really get this idea that some, like, the Gathering Storm?
Yeah,
you
know? Yeah. And if people want to, nice reference, by the way.
I know.
if people want to sort of comment, you know, down below in the comment section, just tell us, you know, when were you there at the time? Like, did you see it coming?
Because I missed out on it.
Yeah, we kind of came into it after the fact.
Yeah.
But okay, so when you look at the initial publications, you had the Battle Droids box set, which was BattleTech First Edition, and BattleTech Second Edition had this same kind of layout. But essentially, there was a brief, like, you know, 3 or 4 paragraph entry into sort of providing the background for what BattleTech was, and there was, you know, the mention of the Star League. So this era of perpetual war.
Hanson's Rough Riders was in there,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, the scavenger mentality of the setting. But in that was a mention of Wolf's Dragoons. And it did say, you know, they were well-equipped. There was rumored to be a base outside the successor states where they got all their gear. The Star League was referenced in that intro paragraph, but there wasn't much more than that. You know, so it's cool. The Wolf's Dragoons were mentioned initially with this base outside the successor
states. It's a nice little entry that makes you go, huh, that's kind of weird.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, it's that same paragraph that's in second edition and third edition. They just lifted that and just plopped that back in for the setting. And then in 1985, after BattleTech second edition, we've got The Tales of the Black Widow Company with Natasha Kerensky.
Which is where she's first mentioned.
Right. And, you know, they talk about Wolf's Dragoons. They talk about sort of the history of Wolf's Dragoons in the Inner Sphere, but not really anything before that or, you know, a lot of nitty-gritty. And there wasn't any mention of, like, a Star League in that book as far as I could tell, flipping through it. But you see Natasha Kerensky. So that's neat. And I think in many ways, it was a bit progressive of BattleTech to have, you know, a main character or a featured character that was actually female, which was cool. And she's very capable as a mech warrior. And she's referenced as being, you know, a badass.
Definitely looks a lot like Sigourney Weaver.
Yeah. Yeah.
At least back then.
And, all props to that kick-ass Jim Holloway art on the front cover. Yeah. Whether it is the topless version.
You didn't know it was the topless.
As I saw it, and then it was in the Shrek collection. They posted it. And I was like, man, that's...
You're like, that's not true. I was like, no, it is. I've seen it. It's out there.
And she looks... It's one of those things like, yeah, she looks pretty good. Sorry, that's a bit of the male side of me coming out. So it's cool. So we're seeing that. And... I love Jim Holloway's art, like both that and the Fox's Teeth cover art. And I love the design of the infantryman on the cover of the Fox's Teeth, because it just has the futuristic helmet design with these like really neat curves to the glass panels in the helmet and the equipment. It's really cool. And I hope that gets referenced elsewhere. With any new art that comes out, because just stuff like that looks really cool.
I wonder if he was inspired by Mobius.
I'm sure he was. I'm sure those guys were.
Sure,
yeah.
It looks similar.
Yeah, yeah. It's just stuff like that's just really cool, and seeing that. But anyway, so in the Fox's Teeth, you have a mention of the Kerensky Protectorate, I think, and this would be in reference to his regency with Richard Cameron, Alexander Kerensky. But it's not actually. They don't mention Alexander Kerensky. They do mention Stephen Ameris. They only mention Kerensky. So my only assumption is that, yeah, this is Alexander Kerensky. Now, if you're astute, right, you're probably looking... If you have both books, you're probably like, huh, the Kerensky Protectorate and Natasha Kerensky.
Like,
these are separated by hundreds of years, but like...
Yeah, Kerensky's, how did that lineage
It's not exactly like a Smith last name, right? Like, this Kerensky name's got to mean something, right? And so I think this is when you're starting to see they must be sort of tying things together.
Yeah, you had the Star League book before... The two we were referring, like Fox's Teeth and that, right?
The Star League source book?
Yeah.
That was, I think, 88.
It was 88?
Yeah,
okay.
So we still got a while before this stuff comes out.
Okay, I was just curious to see if, like, we knew about Kerensky before Natasha or after her.
I think it's after.
Okay.
It's after. And so then you get to 86. Now, 86 was a really good year for Battletech. Because you get the second edition. Second edition was 85. But you get...
You have scenario books.
You have scenario books. The really interesting thing is that TRO 3025 comes out by SKU number, comes out after MechWarrior First Edition. So MechWarrior First Edition, you've got some really cool charts that have like random encounter tables for like battle mech lances.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got the core mechs from Battletech box set, and it has the kind of referenced house battle mechs in the back of MechWarrior First Edition. So like the Dragon and Panther for Krita, Vindicator for Lao, Enforcer Valkyrie for Davian, Hermes 2 for the Free Worlds League, and the Zeus and Commando for the Lyran Commonwealth. So those are included in those random encounter tables. But the artwork is actually the loose artwork from TRO 3025. So you tell that they're working on things at the same time. I don't know like how they plan things out, but they're working on books at the same time.
It's almost like they were foreshadowing the arrival of their big technical readout.
Right, right. So they must just pull the artwork from that, and then 3025 comes out later. But it's in MechWarrior First Edition in the appendices at the back of the book that really lays out the story and history of the Battletech universe. And so you've got really the really first mention of Alexander Kerensky, as in Alexander Kerensky, not just the Kerensky Protectorate, but Kerensky by name, and the Exodus, and the Fall of the Star League, and the Rise of Comstar. So that's when you get those things. And so I think at this point, hopefully you're putting things together, right? And you're saying, oh, Natasha Kerensky, Wolf's Dragoons have this base, a presumed base outside the successor states. They have this well-equipped mercenary force. You have this person with this last name that's only been referenced somewhere else, and the Star League and the Exodus of the Star League military. So at this point, you're probably hopefully putting things together and you're seeing where it's going. And then 86, you got the release of TRL 3025. And then in 87 throughout 89, you've got a lot of this stuff for...
your house books.
The house books, the Fourth Succession War. You've got the release of the Wolves on the Border novel by Robert Charette in 89. And granted, they don't mention the clans, they don't mention where the Wolf Dragons came from, but you can tell like the way they talk and the way their their lingo is in the Wolf Striking Games. You can tell that they're different. They're different. And then you got the Wolf Striking Games source book, which goes in a lot of detail about like their runs to their secret base outside the Inner Sphere, the Anton Marek Civil War, a lot of kind of things that are leading somewhere. And so I'm wondering, like, again, like, at the time, because there weren't web fora. I mean, maybe there were, like, there wasn't even really the internet. So there wasn't even mail, like, email chains and chat letters and stuff like that. So
there were phone calls.
Yeah. So among the, phone calls. Wow. So among the community, like, where people, like, when they go to conventions, they're like, oh, man, you think we're going to see, you know, the return of the SLDF and that kind of stuff? And then in 1989, you had the 20-year update and TRO 2750. And so I'm just sort of wondering, like, oh, man, you know, is this, like, where people see, like, 20-year update goes up to the year 3049. And I think just the start of the year 3050, because I believe the clan invasion starts, like, what, May of 3050?
No.
Because there were... Because they talk about the 20-year update, how...
The first time they witnessed them was the Cowhounds on the Rock, wasn't
right,
it?
Right, right.
Yeah.
So we know in the 20-year update, they talk about losing contact with the Bandit Kingdoms. So the Bandit Kingdoms were part of the Coreward periphery, which were, if you look at a map, so the 12 o'clock region of...
Yeah, like, right above the Free Rasahog Republic.
Free Rasahog Republic, Lyran Commonwealth, and Draconis Combine. So those guys, they lose contact with them, and the Kellhounds were on the Rock there, I think, chasing after Red Jack Ryan and his band of thieves. But, you know, it's pretty clear that things are heading somewhere big. And so the Wolves on the Border show you interesting, unique dialogue. Unity, exclamations of unity is sort of like a... You know, like in French, they've got this saying, like, Zotelors, kind of that thing. It's not really a swear, but it could be a swear. It's just sort of this exclamation of frustration.
Yeah, like an oorah, you know?
Yeah. and then it's in September 1989 when Lethal Heritage is published, the first book of the Blood of Kerensky trilogy by Michael Stackpole.
The Kellhounds.
Yeah. And then in 1990, we get TRO 3050. We get Blood Legacy in December 1990, which I believe is when the Wolf's Dragoons did their big reveal to the leaders of the successor states, telling them, hey, you know, in-universe, hey, you know all those things you were thinking about us? They were right. and then in September 91 is when you get Lost Destiny. Now, I'm able to give you guys months for when the novels came out, because I think the months are actually included in the novels themselves. Like in the beginning, like the first like a couple pages, they'll tell you when it was published. And a lot of this line out I got from Sarna. So Sarna has a list of Battletech publications and then a list of Battletech novels in the order they were published.
You could basically follow what we were talking about on Sarna.net.
Yeah. Oddly, More Tales of the Black Widow was published in 1990, which had a lot of information in terms of what the Wolf Dragoons were doing in the interregnum years between 3028 and 3039, and then 3039 to the clan invasion. And if you follow it, it's got stuff when Natasha Kerensky leaves the Wolf's Dragoons and joins up with Clan Wolf, goes through her trials again, kicks a bunch of ass, you know, forms her, you know, new cluster of warriors, and then like the hunt for Ragnar Magnusson on Razzlehog, and her sort of taking Felyn Kell under her wing. And all that kind of stuff. And when she becomes Khan of Clan Wolf. So I just wonder, you know, like here on the line out, it seems obvious in retrospect, like, oh, this was obviously building towards something. And you know, even then, if you read the novels particularly, you could see even the Comstar stuff is building towards something. That's a whole other thing. That's a whole other podcast.
Comstar is its own, its own
but
thing.
You could see Comstar's sort of shady dealings, I think, at least as early as... the last novel in the Greatest Legion trilogy, and what they were doing. And then, you know, in retrospect, the Anton Marek Civil War. There's also the Spider and the Wolf graphic novel, which... Have you read that yet, Dan?
No.
No, okay. I'll let you borrow my copy, if I can find a PDF or something.
I think I have it.
You have it?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's... even by comic book standards in the 1980s, it's not that good. You know, that's not to knock on the people who worked on it, but it's just it's not that good. Like, the art is confusing, the layout's confusing, the layout of the speech bubbles is not that great. You can also tell that they were leaning heavily. I mean, this is one of the reasons why BattleTech, even with the legal troubles that came with the whole classics and the sort of release of all these designs, like, it needed that. It needed these mechs because they were in everything up to TRL 3025 and even beyond. Like, they were everywhere. And in the Spider and the Wolf graphic novel, almost every mech was one of those designs. But in there is, they talk a little bit more of the Wolf's Dragoons, and there's a section with Vester Christopher, the Comstar agent that was kind of manipulating Anton Merrick to try and push the Wolf's Dragoons into doing their supply run so Comstar could follow them and see where they were coming from. But despite how bad it is, I mean, there were some interesting things in it that would become canon. I mean, it was sort of our exposure to Jamie Wolf's brother, Joshua Wolf, who was killed by Anton Merrick, and his relationship with Natasha Kerensky, and where she gained the moniker the Black Widow. There's also a really interesting uber 1980s illustration of General Alexander Kerensky with a full head of hair and an eye patch and a very sort of like...
Which, that was the first picture of him, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah. I think by chronologically, in terms of publication, that was his first picture. And he's got this like really cool uniform. It's sort of, I don't know what it's inspired by. Like, it's sort of like
80s action movies,
18th, 19th century, like futuristic European garb. He's got like a beard, like a goat with a goatee, a mustache and goatee beard.
His eye patch.
And his eye patch. Yeah. It actually looks pretty cool. Like, that'd be cool to like cosplay as that. And who are you? It's like, I'm Alexander Kerensky. It's like, no, you're not. You're not bald. It's like, no.
Yes, I am. Throw the picture down.
Yeah. and then I think then, I'm not sure which house book it was. It was either, because I think Starlight came out last of those books. Maybe it was a Kurita house book that had like the first illustration of Alexander Kerensky. And that's when he's bald. And that would become sort of the canonical version of Kerensky. Now, for those of you who are astute, you know, the name Alexander Kerensky was lifted from one of the famous generals of World War I, and who would later play a part in the Russian Civil War, which would lead to the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia. So Alexander Kerensky was this, you know, it was a name lifted. Whatever order it was in the BattleTech universe was also lifted from an order that was issued, I think, back in World War I. And so they were lifting pretty heavily from history to get a lot of inspiration and fill out the meat of the universe. And so, so that's where the name Alexander Kerensky comes from, which also apparently is kind of wrong in a sense, because I think Russia is, their last names tend to be matronymic versus patronymic. So like, Kerensky's technically the wrong last name, but no.
You know, I mean, it's whatever. The future.
Whatever. Yeah.
Everything's
whatever.
Mixed up. We got Swedenese, you know?
Yeah. So yeah, again, I just wonder, you know, back in the day, for people who were playing, did it seem obvious that this was where it was heading? Because now, I mean, to us, yeah, I mean, right now, yeah, it's like, yeah, where else would it have gone?
I know.
Now, the only thing
what did they see?
Yeah,
the clans. I mean, well, they wouldn't even really be known as the clans, but what were they thinking?
Right, like, what was it going to look like? Their way?
Was it going to be the mechs we got in, was it 2750?
Yeah,
that were doing the invasion? Was it? Or was it the BS clan tech we got now?
Yeah. And so, yeah, the clans obviously ended up becoming something way different than I think many of us thought it would be. And a lot of that history is given to us via the Jade Falcon and Clan Wolf source books.
Yeah, those are the actual first two source books that came out for the clans. Hmm. And then we got, after that, Invading Clans.
Actually, I think Invading Clans came out relatively late. It was quite a while before we got that information. It may have even come out the same year that TRO 3055 came out.
It is the only book that actually has the entry for Clan Smoke Jaguar in it.
No. Wow.
Before, the two field manuals for the clans, because the Jaguars aren't in the Crusader.
So, yeah, so by timeline, because I think, yeah, the field manuals are dated after Operations Bulldog and Serpent. So, yeah. So that was a bit of a history lesson there on the beginning of the clans, the sort of what looks to be them kind of putting down the ideas. Now, we do know that the writers would have summits, like they'd get together and they'd plan out products for a couple of years. And I'm wondering, you know, it seems somewhere between 85 and 86, they were really sort of fleshing out the backstory. Battletech is not the first property to have an ongoing meta plot for the game. But I think it's one of the most successful ones. It is among the first, and it's certainly among the most successful to have an ongoing meta plot.
I mean, it's been around for so long. Yeah. I'm just, it, when you look at it, even how it developed, it almost seems like they had a different idea, maybe, for the clans when they were coming up with it.
Well, yeah, originally,
I don't see why they wouldn't.
Right, and originally they made it sound in the Battle Droids box set, there weren't any more battle mech factories. Like, this was it. Like, what you have is what you've got, and every time you lose a battle mech, you're permanently erasing a mech from the universe. And obviously that changed. That changed, I think, at least as early as
right at
3025.
Yeah, what really did it, well, 3025, you started seeing new mechs like the Hatchet Man.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, factories were just coming into play, but it really didn't hit until the Memory Core. The Helm Memory Core?
Yeah.
Because that's in that era before, I think they did some kind of retcon later, but it was towards the invasion when factories really started to kick up, when we started getting...
Well, that would change, too.
Yeah.
Because you see a lot of prototype weapons in...
Well, it was the base Starly Tech we got in 2750 and in City Tech. So
yeah.
Your ER Large Laser, your Ultra Auto Cannon 5, yeah. Just like the bare minimum.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and that's another thing, too, is sort of the way the... That's a whole other podcast, too, is sort of the... how things changed in universe in terms of how it was presented and how bad the technological decline actually was and how bad it would be depending on where you were located. Clearly, you know, as they were kind of going, things were changing in universe in terms of how they were being thought about, how they were being presented, where it was going to go.
Well, in context, you can see, like, the clans were not rushed.
Right. Right,
they definitely were not rushed. It was something that they did think about. As much as the technology likes to imply it was rushed,
yeah,
it wasn't.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's cool. So to see that things were going somewhere. And that's why I wish... So there's one of my favorite bands is King Crimson, and there's a pretty cool book written about the history of the band. And actually, they just put out a second edition, which is even bigger. Like, oh, my God, it's, like, it's super... thick. I don't know what I'm gonna read it, but it's neat talking to, you know, the guy who wrote it obviously talked to a lot of the band members, some of whom are no longer with us, and like previous band members, and we wrote this song and this is where we came up with these different licks, and this is who came up with this part, this is who came up with that part. Oh, I lifted this part from a practice scale or set of arpeggios I would work on, and I just sort of changed the rhythm around and that's how I got this lick. Oh, and, you know, we had this song, we recycled parts from this other song we had like 7 years ago that we never really recorded in the studio, we just play it live. So we just took this idea and then plopped it into this song. That's where we got this sort of chugging bass line. And so it's kind of cool to have these ideas. It's why I wish that we get sort of an insider's look. And I know that the writers don't want to give up any information in terms of, you know, where the story is going, because they want to make sure people buy the future books, right? But I think, you know, academically, it'd just be really interesting to see, oh, you know, how'd you guys come up with this? Where'd you guys lift this idea? You know, who came up with where this was going to go? And it'd just be neat to see, oh, yeah, you know, I took inspiration from this historical event, or this is when we were starting to come up with the idea for the clans, and then this is how we sort of foreshadowed it. And I think in terms of fiction, what I described, you know, is kind of how you could see this is when this idea was coming through, and this is when they were sort of solidifying it, and how they were sort of, you know, they were foreshadowing it. And, you know, Battletech having an ongoing meta plot both hurts it and helps it in ways that I think other games don't experience. Obviously, it keeps us engaged. You know, Dungeons and Dragons doesn't have an ongoing meta plot in the same way that, you know, Battletech does. I mean, they got modules and stuff, but
the plot is really the scenario books that they put out.
Right. Right. Even Warhammer 40K, right? And that's not to knock 40K, but you know, you've got this grimdark world where everything sucks and everyone's miserable, and you've got sort of the histories for these interstellar powers that explains their drives and motivations, but I never really got the impression there was much to describe what's going on. I know they have novels and stuff like that, but it's not like the Imperium of Man is going to fall apart and disappear. It's always going to be there because the Space Marines are the most popular, you know, thing. Whereas in Battletech, different powers can you know, seriously be in jeopardy. And who knows what's going to end up happening after the Ill Clan.
All the Free Wrestle Hog Republic fans out there rejoiced, and then the clans took them out. Took them out real quick.
Yeah.
Like, why would you take this from me? Yeah. I'm one of them. It's okay.
So it's obviously, you know, the early 80s, you know, that it's kind of funny to think, you know, how fast those couple of years must have really gone by. And there's a lot of material released, a lot of material, not just the number of books, but the number of words printed for those first, you know, 6 years of Battletech up to the clans. But obviously, like, you couldn't stay in this perpetual state of technological degradation. And I think it would have been nice to see... Well, because everything kind of played out in the novels, it would have been nice to see maybe the Fourth Succession War last longer, or to see more experimentation and more time set into the interregnum years between 28 and 39, or, you know, even 39 to 50.
I mean, we just got the birth... I mean, I could reference the Wrasse Hog Republic again. We just got a birth of that... You know, that nation, it would have been nice to see them at least last a couple decades.
Yeah.
Instead of the, what, how long they last? Like 5 years or was it like that? 5 or 10 years?
Was Wrasse Hog before or after? It was after 39, right?
Yeah, it was after. Because
they had the Ronin Wars.
Yeah, they had the Ronin Wars, and then they had the formation of the Republic.
Yeah.
I mean, they've always been there since the beginning. I mean, they were always referenced, even like, back to the Wrasse Hog Consortium in the Draconis Combine book.
Yeah.
But, you know, they didn't have time to shine as a faction as long as they probably could have.
Yeah. And it's, and I know that they've found ways to keep Wrasse Hog a player, you know, whether it was...
Well, sort of merging with Comstar.
Yeah, being there for Comstar. Their tech,
and then now merging with Clan Ghost Bear.
Right.
Wrasse Hog Dominion.
And giving the like, say, like the Magnusons, you know, a future, you know, because it was the Magnusons were sort of the new kind of house lords, even though it seemed like their political system was different from a lot of the other houses. But by giving them future play in the universe by giving Ragnar Magnusson a chance to become Sakon of the Ghost Bears, and then, you know, their own bloodline and everything, which was good to see. And I think that sort of plays into another topic, sort of the evolution of clan culture, which is a whole other thing, and I think the pros and cons of it. But you sort of run, there's sort of this constraint of the ongoing meta plot and how it plays with the game system, and then wanting to do something adventurous and interesting and showing change and progression. And I'm sure this is the thing that the writers have to deal with, that they can't change things too much. That's a whole lot to talk about. That's like a not to be the next episode, because that's a whole
sort of our part two into the clans. How far do we get into this?
Yeah, I think we got into it quite a while. This is the thing, we probably should actually get to the point where we get a decent microphone. So we've been talking for about an hour, man.
Wow,
that just zipped by. That holy really crap! Zipped. Yeah. So I think you know, it's one of those things, because we were talking about this earlier, and you know, one of the tricky things about Battletech, much like comic books, is that you'll have a comic book story arc, right? And you can never really kill the Joker, because you have to bring him back from the dead, or you got to keep him alive, because Batman needs to be published ad infinitum, because you can't ever not have a Batman comic book, right? Yeah. That's why you can't just randomly kill the villains, because there's always got to be future storylines.
You cannot kill Dr. Wily. What else is Mega Man going to do?
Right. Because even like in Mega Man X, you know, They had
Wily's reference.
Yeah, Wily's still referenced. And there, I think they missed an opportunity with Mega Man X because it could have brought back Dr. Wily. It would have been a lot more interesting than seeing Sigma again and again.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, man. How many
Cyber Wily.
Yeah, how many things are we going to fucking talk about? So I mean, it's kind of a rock and a hard place for the writers because
Rockman, Mega Man.
Oh man. Because in comic book story arcs, you know, they're always kind of laying the foundation for something else. You know, there's some sort of story seed or a cliffhanger at the end of like a 4-issue arc for the next 2 or 3 arcs, or maybe it'll show up 4 arcs later. Grant Morrison in particular is very good at this when he would write stuff. And so was Jeff Johns. And it's tough. And, you know, BattleTech's done that with, you know, Comstar and the Clans and the Star League Defense Force, and little plot threads. I think I wish they'd do it more with other things. I wish they'd do it more with little side stories, you know, and conflicts like intra-house conflicts rather than inter-house conflicts. So, the Fed Sons in particular have always been written as being kind of the white knights. And Jordan Wiseman made mention that he tried not to do that. And it kind of didn't happen that way, for better or for worse. At least it wasn't perceived that way. And what was interesting to me is that it seemed to play out better in the Free Worlds League and the Lyran Commonwealth to a certain extent. It was sort of referenced that way in the Federated Sons, sort of conflicts between the Hasics of the Capellan March and the Sandovals of the Draconis March and then the Davian royal family. I think we needed to see more conflicts that way. Of course, we did see it with Michael Hasek Davian and Hans Davian, but that sort of wrapped itself in a neat little bow at the end of the Fourth Succession War.
Yeah.
But you kind of always have to have these plot threads, all these ideas going, and something's always has to lead into something else. And BattleTech clearly did that. And
well, BattleTech's also unique, too, in the fact that when they come up with these plot threads, not all of them go somewhere.
Because they're designed for us as plot hooks to use in our stories at the table.
BattleTech's very good at that.
Yeah, because it's one of the things is I kind of haven't felt that recently, and maybe that's my perspective.
The only one that comes to mind is coming up with the origins for Stone, Devin Stone.
They're Devlin Stone. Yeah. I think BattleTech kind of needs it to be a bit of a sandbox, and they're definitely like in the handbook series that they did kind of had a lot of those plot hooks in there. The Turning the Stars series they did, the PDFs with planets, had their own sort of plot hooks that played into how a time of war worked.
Even the MechWarrior First Edition and even the Mercenaries Handbook. Because mercenaries are really your bread and butter for every BattleTech player.
I think one thing for me, though, that I felt the game lost with the coming of the clans was that it's been like this. It's sort of like event fatigue, to kind of bring it back to comic books again, is that you have these writers come up with these ideas for comics, but what ends up happening is that an event happens and everything that writers have been working on for the past year gets totally sidelined because every series has to tie into the event. It's a way for the comic book companies to maximize comic book sales. It's like, oh, I got to find out what happened with this. It's kind of one of the reasons why DC's Final Crisis was originally not well received, at least initially, was because they had all these different comic books that were supposed to be tie-ins, but actually had, you know, major story ideas that made the core series make sense. With BattleTech, you had sort of room to play, and then the clans came. The clans were such an existential threat to the Inner Sphere that everything becomes Inner Sphere versus clan.
It turned into 1v1.
Yeah, and so you didn't. I mean, you could do whatever you want at any point. You could tell any story you want really at any point. You could still tell a Succession Wars style story in the Dark Age. It doesn't really matter. But something about it just feels like you get to the clans. The clans kind of take everything. You get to the FedCom Civil War. The FedCom Civil War kind of takes up everything. You get to the Jihad. Jihad definitely takes up everything. Then you get to the Dark Age, and the lack of the HP generators or the HP grid takes up everything. And then you get the whole shitstorm with the fall of the Republic of the Sphere.
And that takes up everything. And granted, those are big, exciting events, and there's definitely a reason why they're there. And maybe it's just because we've been stuck in this dark age period for so long because we just haven't gotten to the end of it yet because the writers haven't put out those books. And there are reasons why they haven't put it out, you know, but it's just like we haven't gotten to it yet, and I just want it to fucking end so we can get to the next
one. Give us Hillclan already.
Yeah, so we can kind of get back to our sandbox experiment. So, yeah. Yeah. I kind of rambled there for a bit. Sorry, guys.
No, that's all right. Yeah. That's pretty much what our show is.
Adam talking out of his ass.
I wonder where else. I don't know. I guess maybe we can.
I mean, I think it's good for now. I mean, we gotta kind of lay out the next episode because I think it's going to be a lot more nitty gritty on the clans.
Yeah, we might talk about.
I think the tech,
the actual technology,
the technology, and how it affected the board game experience. And I think what we've experienced in terms of the board game, I think what people at the time experienced, you know, from what we've been told what it was like when you're playing a game and the clans came out and then you had these people that just want to play clan tech and how the game was balanced. I think the other thing is...
it might be worth taking a look at the clans the same way from like the meta perspective.
Yeah.
Maybe go as far back to see what homeworld clans are actually referenced in the first two clan books, the Wolf and Jade Falcon book.
I want to say that
how many of them were actually in there.
I want to say they were in there because, you know, the other thing too is
I know they're referenced in the fluff, yeah. But it'd be interesting to go back and see who's in there.
Yeah, yeah. Because, you know, it's like when you look at sort of like references to the clans when they were coming, I mean, even in the Draconis Combine, I'm sorry, the House Kurita source book, and they're talking about the Minnesota tribe. Like, clearly, I mean, this is, things were going somewhere. I guess, I mean, to sum up where we're going to be going next episode, Zellbrigand is a lie.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Zellbrigand's a lie, which I think makes the clans more human and realistic.
No.
Well, the lies we tell ourselves. The lies we tell ourselves.
Makes them more Nikolai Malthus.
Maybe. But yeah, so yeah, stay tuned, guys. Stay tuned.
We promise we're not going to make the clan sound terrible.
Well.
I take my promise back.
I'll try.